Chapter 2. Nathaniel. As had become his custom in recent months, the great magician John Mandrake took his breakfast in his parlour, seated in the wicker chair beside the window. The heavy curtains had been carelessly drawn back. The sky beyond was grey and leaden, and a sinewy mist threaded its way between the trees of the square. The small circular table before him was carved from Lebanese cedar. When warmed by sunlight, it gave off a pleasant fragrance. But on this particular morning, the wood was dark and cold. Mandrake poured coffee into his glass, removed the silver cover from his plate, and set upon his curried eggs and bacon. In a rack behind the toast and the gooseberry conserve sat a crisply folded newspaper and an envelope with a blood-red seal. Mandrake took a swig of coffee with his left hand. With his right, he flicked the newspaper open on the table. He glanced at the front page, grunted dismissively, and reached for the envelope. An ivory paper knife hung from a peg upon the rack. Flinging down his fork, Mandrake slit the envelope with one easy motion and drew out a folded parchment. He read this with care, brows puckering into a frown. Then he refolded it, stuffed it back into the envelope, and with a sigh returned to his meal. A knock at the door. With mouth half full of bacon, Mandrake gave a muffled command. The door opened silently, and a young, slim woman stepped diffidently through, a briefcase in her hand. She halted.
"I'm sorry, sir," she began. "Am I too early?"
"Not at all, Piper. Not at all." He waved her over, indicated a chair on the other side of his breakfast table. "Have you eaten?"
"Yes, sir."
She sat. She wore a dark blue skirt and jacket with a crisp white shirt. Her straight brown hair was scraped away from her forehead and clipped at the back of her head. She settled the briefcase on her lap. Mandrake speared a forkful of curried egg. "Forgive me if I keep eating," he said. "I was up until 3, responding to the latest disturbance. Kent, this time." Miss Piper nodded.
"I heard, sir. There was a memo at the Ministry. Was it contained?"
"Yes, as far as my globe could tell, at any rate. I sent a few demons down. Well, we shall see presently. What have you got for me today?" She unclipped the briefcase and drew out some papers.
"A number of proposals from the junior ministers, sir, regarding the propaganda campaigns in the outlying regions. For your approval. Some new poster ideas?"
"Let's see." He took a gulp of coffee, held out a hand. "Anything else?"
"With the minutes of the last council meeting?"
"I'll read that later. Posters first." He scanned the topmost page. "Sign up to serve your country and see the world." "What's that supposed to mean?" "More like a holiday brochure than recruitment. Far too soft. Keep talking, Piper. I'm still listening."
"We've got the latest frontline reports from America, sir. I've ordered them a little. We should be able to make another story out of the Boston siege."
"Stressing the heroic attempt, not the abject failure, I trust." Balancing the papers on his knee, he smeared some gooseberry conserve upon a piece of toast.
"Well, I'll try writing something later. Now then, this one's okay. Defend the mother country and make your name."
"Good.
They're suggesting a farm boy type, looking manly, which is fine. But how about putting his family group, say, parents and little sister, in the background, looking vulnerable and admiring? Play the domestic card."
Miss Piper nodded eagerly.
"Could show his wife, too, sir." "No, we're after the single ones. It's the wives who are most troublesome when they don't come back."
He crunched on his toast.
"Any other messages?" "One from Mr. Makepeace, sir. Came by imp. Wonders if you'll drop by and see him this morning."
"Can't. Too busy. There'll be time later."
"His imp also dropped off this flyer."
With a rueful face, Miss Piper held up a lilac-coloured paper.
"It's advertising the premiere of his play later this week. From Wapping to Westminster, it's called. The story of our Prime Minister's rise to glory. An evening we will never forget, apparently."
Mandrake gave a groan. "If only we could. Put it in the bin. We've got better things to do than discuss theatre. What else?"
"Mr. Devereux has sent a memo around too. Owing to the troublesome times, sir, he's placed the nation's most important treasures under special guard in the vaults of Whitehall. they will remain there until he says otherwise." Mandrake looked up then, frowning.
"Treasures? Such as what?"
"He doesn't say. I wonder if it'll be—"
"It'll be the staff and the amulet and the other Grade One items," he hissed briefly through his teeth. "That's not what he should be doing, Piper. We need them used."
"Yes, sir." "There's also this from Mr. Devereux."
She brought out a slender packet. The magician eyed it grimly.
"Not another toga. A mask, sir, for the party this evening."
With a cry, he indicated the envelope in the rack.
"I've already got the invitation. It beggars belief. The war's going badly, the Empire's teetering on the brink, and all our Prime Minister can think about is plays and parties. All right, keep it with the documents. I'll take it along. The posters seem okay."
He handed back the papers. "Maybe not snappy enough." He thought for a moment, nodded.
"Got a pen? Try 'Fight for Freedom and the British Way.' Doesn't mean anything, but it sounds good."
Miss Piper considered it.
"I think it's rather profound, sir."
"Excellent. Then the commoners'll snap it up."
He stood, dabbed his mouth with a napkin, and tossed it down upon the tray.
"Well, we'd better see how the demons have been getting on."
"No, no, Piper, please. After you."
If Miss Piper regarded her employer with more than a little wide-eyed admiration, she was by no means alone among the women of the elite. John Mandrake was an attractive young man, and the scent of power hung about him, sweet and intoxicating, like honeysuckle in the evening air. He was of medium height, slender of body, and swift and confident in action. His pale, slim face presented an intriguing paradox. Combining extreme youth, he was still only 17 years old, with experience and authority. His eyes were dark and quick and serious, his forehead prematurely lined. His intellectual self-assurance, which had once perilously outstripped his other skills, had now been bolstered by a certain social poise. To peers and inferiors alike he was courteous and charming at all times, although also somewhat remote, as if distracted by an inner melancholy. Alongside the crude appetites and eccentricities of his fellow ministers, this subdued detachment attained an elegance that only added to his mystique. Mandrake wore his dark hair close in a military crop, a conscious innovation to honour the men and women still at war. It had been a successful gesture. Spies noted that among commoners he was the most popular magician. His haircut had thus been mimicked by many others, while his dark suits had likewise inspired a brief vogue. He no longer bothered with a tie. The collar of his shirt was casually unbuttoned. Mr. Mandrake was considered by his rivals to be formidably, indeed dangerously, talented, and, following his promotion to Information Minister, they responded accordingly. But each attempted assassination had been cursorily rebuffed. Jinn failed to return, booby traps rebounded on the sender, hexes snapped and withered. At last, tiring of this, Mandrake made a point of publicly challenging any hidden enemy to come forward and tackle him in magical combat. No one answered his call, and his standing rose higher than ever. He lived in an elegant Georgian townhouse, surrounded by other elegant Georgian townhouses, on a broad and pleasant square. It was half a mile from Whitehall, and sufficiently far from the river to escape its smell in summer. The square was a generous expanse of beech trees and shady walkways, with an open green in the centre. It was quiet and unfrequented, though never unobserved. Grey-uniformed police patrolled the perimeter by day. After dark, demons in the form of owls and nightjars flitted quietly from tree to tree. This security was due to the inhabitants of the square. It was home to several of London's greatest magicians. On the south side, Mr. Collins, the recently appointed Home Secretary, dwelt in a cream-coloured house decorated with fake pillars and buxom caryatids. To the northwest sprawled the grandiose pile of the War Minister, Mr. Mortensen, with a golden dome glinting upon the roof. John Mandrake's residence was less ostentatious. A slender, four-storey building, painted buttercup yellow, it was reached by a row of white marble steps. White shutters bordered the tall windows.
The rooms were soberly furnished, with delicately patterned wallpapers and Persian rugs upon the floors. The minister did not flaunt his status. He displayed few treasures in the reception rooms, and employed just 2 human servants to keep house. He slept on the 3rd floor, in a plain, whitewashed room adjoining his library. These were his private chambers, which no one visited. On the floor below, separated from the other rooms of the house by an empty, echoing corridor, lined with panels of stained wood, was Mr. Mandrake's study. Here he conducted much of his daily work. Mandrake walked along the corridor, chewing a vestige of toast. Miss Piper tripped along behind. At the end of the corridor was a solid brass door, decorated in its centre by a moulded brass face of surpassing ugliness. Its bulbous brows appeared to be melting down across the eyes. The chin and nose jutted out like nutcracker handles. The magician halted and gazed at the face with deep disapproval.
"I thought I told you to stop doing that," he snapped.
A thin-lipped mouth opened, the jutting chin and nose knocked together indignantly.
"Do what?" "Taking on such a hideous appearance. I've just had my breakfast."
A section of brow lifted, allowing an eyeball to roll forward with a squelching sound. The face looked unapologetic.
"Sorry, mate," it said. "It's just my job." "Your job is to destroy anyone entering my study without authority. No more, no less."
The door guard considered.
"True, but I seek to preempt entry by scaring trespassers away. To my way of thinking, deterrence is more aesthetically satisfying than punishment."
Mr. Mandrake snorted.
"Trespassers apart, you'll likely frighten Miss Piper here to death."
The face shook from side to side, a process that caused the nose to wobble alarmingly.
"Not so. When she comes alone, I moderate my features. I reserve the full horror for those I consider morally vicious. But you just look that way to me. The contradiction being?"
Mandrake took a deep breath, passed a hand across his eyes, and gestured. The face retreated into the metal to become the faintest of outlines. The door swung open. The great magician drew himself up, and ushering Miss Piper along before him, walked into his study. It was a functional room, high, airy, and white-painted, lit by 2 windows looking out upon the square. It had no excess decoration. On this particular morning, thick clouds covered the sun, so Mandrake switched on the ceiling lights as he entered. Bookcases ran along the entirety of one wall, while the opposite side was bare, except for a giant pinboard covered in notes and diagrams. The wooden floor was smooth and dark. 5 circles were inscribed upon it, each with its own pentacle, runes, candles, and incense pots. 4 of these were of a conventional size, but the 5th, nearest the window, was significantly larger. It contained within it a full-size desk, filing cabinet, and several chairs. This master circle was joined to the smaller ones by a series of precisely drawn lines and rune chains. Mandrake and Miss Piper crossed into the largest circle and sat behind the desk, spreading out their papers before them.
"Right, then. To business.
Miss Piper, we will deal with the ordinary reports first. If you would activate the presence indicator..." Miss Piper spoke a brief incantation. Instantly the candles around the perimeters of 2 of the smaller circles flickered into life. Wisps of smoke rose to the ceiling. In the pots beside them, flakes of incense stirred and shifted. The other 2 circles remained quiet.
"Purib and Fritang," Miss Piper said.
The magician nodded.
"Purib first."
He uttered a loud command. The candles in the leftmost pentacle flared with a queasy shimmering. A form appeared in the centre of the circle. It was shaped like a man, and respectfully dressed in a sober suit and dark blue tie. It nodded briefly in the direction of the desk, and waited.
"Remind me," Mandrake said.
Miss Piper glanced at her notes.
"Purip has been observing the response to our war pamphlets and other propaganda," she said, "watching the commoner's mood." "Very well. Purip, what have you seen? Speak."
The demon bowed slightly.
"There is not much new to report. The people are like a herd of Ganges meadow cattle, half-starved but complacent, unused to change or independent thought.
Yet the war presses on their minds, and I believe discontent is spreading. They read your pamphlets just as they buy your newspapers, but they do so without pleasure. It does not satisfy them." The magician scowled. "How is this discontent expressed?" "I detect it in the careful blankness of their features when your police draw near. I see it in the hardness of their eyes as they pass the recruitment booths. I watch it pile up silently with the flowers at the doors of the bereaved. Most will not declare it openly, but their anger at the war and at their government is growing."
"These are just words," Mandrake said. "You give me nothing tangible."
The demon shrugged its shoulders and smiled. "Revolution is not tangible, not to begin with. The commoners barely know the concept exists, but they breathe it when they sleep, and they taste it when they drink."
"That's enough, Riddles. Continue with your work."
The magician snapped his fingers. The demon sprang out of the circle and vanished. Mandrake shook his head.
"All but useless. Well, we'll see what Fritang has to offer."
Another command? The second circle flared into life. In a cloud of incense, a new demon appeared. A short, fat gentleman with a round red face and plaintive eyes. It stood blinking agitatedly in the artificial light.
"At last!" it cried. "I have terrible news. It cannot wait another moment."
Mandrake knew Fritang of old. "As I understand it," he said slowly, "you have been patrolling the docks, hunting for spies. Does your news have anything to do with this?" A pause.
"Indirectly,"
the demon said. Mandrake sighed. "Go on, then."
"I was carrying out your orders," Fritang said, "when, oh, how the memory appalls me, my cover was blown. Here is my account. I had been conducting inquiries in a wine shop. As I exited, I found myself surrounded by a tribe of street urchins, some scarcely taller than my knee. I was disguised as a manservant, going about my quiet business. I had made no loud noises or extravagant gestures. Nevertheless, I was singled out and hit by 15 eggs, mostly thrown with force."
"What was your exact guise? Perhaps that was itself a provocation."
"I was as you see me, grey-haired, sober, and straight-backed, the model of tedious virtue."
"Evidently the young scoundrels decided to waylay a man of such qualities. You were unlucky, that is all." Fritang's eyes widened, and its nostrils flared.
"There was more to it than that. They knew me for what I am."
"As a demon?" Mandrake flicked skeptically at a particle of dust upon his sleeve. "How could you tell?"
"My suspicions were aroused by their repetitive chanting. Get out, get out, vile demon! We hate you and your dangling yellow crest!"
"Really? That is interesting." The magician appraised Fritang carefully through his lenses. "But what yellow crest is this? I don't see it." The demon pointed at a space above its head.
"That is because you cannot see the sixth or seventh planes. On those my crest is self-evident, resplendent as a sunflower. I may add that it is not dangling, though captivity does make it droop a little."
"The sixth and seventh planes? And you're quite sure you didn't let your guise slip for a moment?" "Yes, yes." Mandrake held up a hasty hand as the demon began a vehement protest. "I'm sure you're right, and I'm grateful for the information. You will doubtless want to rest after your egg trauma. Begone. You are dismissed." With a yell of delight, Fritang departed in corkscrew motion through the center of the pentacle, as if sucked noisily down a plug hole. Mandrake and Miss Piper looked at each other.
"Another case," Miss Piper said. "Children again.
The magician leaned back in his chair and stretched his arms out behind his head.
"You might just check the files. Get the exact number. I must summon the demons back from Kent."
He sat forward, his elbows on the desk, and made the incantation in an undertone. Miss Piper got up and crossed to the filing cabinet on the edge of the circle. She opened the topmost drawer and drew out a bulging manila file. Returning to her seat, she removed the elastic around the file and began sifting rapidly through the documents within. The incantation ended amid a suffusion of jasmine and sweetbriar. In the right-hand pentacle a hulking form appeared, a giant with blonde braided hair and a single glaring eye. Miss Piper went on reading. The giant performed a low and complex bow.
"Master, I greet you with the blood of your enemies, with their cries and lamentations. Victory is ours.
Mandrake raised an eyebrow. So you chased them away, then? The Cyclops nodded.
They fled like mice before lions. Literally, in some cases.
Indeed. That was to be expected. But did you capture any?
We killed a good many. You should have heard them squeak, and their fleeing hooves fairly shook the earth.
Right. So you didn't capture a single one, which was expressly what I ordered you and the others to do. Mandrake rapped his fingers on the table. In a matter of days they will attack again. Who sent them? Prague? Paris? America? Without captives, it is impossible to say. We are no further forward. The Cyclops gave a crisp salute.
Well, my work is done. I am pleased to have given satisfaction.
It paused.
You seem lost in thought, O Master.
The magician nodded. I am debating, Ascavol, whether to subject you to the stifles or the unfortunate hug. Do you have a preference?
You could not be so cruel.
The Cyclops wiggled agonizedly back and forth, toying with a braid of hair.
Blame Bartimaeus, not me. Once again he took no useful part in the action, but was waylaid by a single blow. I was delayed from the chase by his loud requests to help him out from beneath a pebble. He is as weak as a tadpole and vicious with it. You should subject him to the stipples forthwith.
And where is Bartimaeus now? The Cyclops gave a pout.
I know not. Possibly he has expired from exhaustion in the interim. He took no part in the chase.
The magician sighed deeply. Ascabol, be gone from here. He made a dismissive sign. The giant's fluting cries of thanks were abruptly cut off. It vanished in a gout of flame. Mandrake turned to his assistant.
Any joy, Piper?
She nodded.
These are the unauthorized demon sightings of the last 6 months. But when you look at the commoners...
She glanced down at the open file.
Most are children, and most of those children are young. In 30 cases, the witnesses were under 18.
What's that?
70% or so. And in over half of those, the witnesses were under 12.
She looked up.
They're being born with it, with the power to see.
And who knows what else? Mandrake swiveled his chair and stared out over the bare grey branches of the trees in the square. Mists still meandered around them, cloaking the ground from view.
All right, he said. That's enough for now. It's nearly 9, and I've private work to do. Thanks for your help, Piper.
I'll see you at the Ministry later this morning. Don't let that door guard give you any cheek as you go out. For some moments after his assistant's departure, the magician remained motionless, tapping his fingers together aimlessly. Finally, he leaned over and opened a side drawer in his desk. He pulled out a small cloth bundle and set it down in front of him. Flicking the fabric aside, he revealed a bronze disc, shiny with the use of years. The magician stared down into the scrying glass, willing it into life. Something stirred in its depths.
"Fetch Bartimaeus," he said.